Welcome to the latest edition of the I Hate Critics Movie Review Podcast. I'm professional film critic Sean Patrick. With me is Jeff.
Hello.
Tell people where they can get your art, Jeff.
JeffLasseter.com is where all my links live. If you go to Instagram, you can follow me at Jeff Lasseter Pop Cult. And that's on Threads as well. I'm kind of on Twitter as Deadsville with a Z. Just go to JeffLasseter.com, and that's got all my links.
Very cool. And what's your latest piece?
Well, I did a commission for one of my cousins that I'm going to be finishing up today or tomorrow. But I'm also, I don't know, I saw Mark Hamill trending last night, so I'm working on a Luke Skywalker piece, like his Eras tour. I'll share it when I'm done.
Very cool. And of course, I have to share this because it was such a cool thing. You went to an estate sale recently and found some incredible stuff.
Yeah. So that's one of my things is because I have a huge Star Wars collection, I'm always on the lookout for, Star Wars stuff. And I have a few collections. There's horror movie stuff, which I'll share some pictures sometime. And I have all the Murder, She Wrote books and DVDs, and I do Murder, She Wrote art. And last week I was at work and I was looking through one of the local, estate sale company's posts and looking for Star Wars stuff. And they had a Murder, She Wrote board game from 1985. I got up way too early and went and sat on the stoop because the person who runs the estate sales, I'm friendly with her. And she said, you know, I said, if you ever come across some Star Wars stuff, just give me a heads up so I can beat some of the toy dealers. And she's like, oh my God, you must have manifested it because I found some stuff. And she goes, I posted pictures on the Facebook page and I went and looked. And as I saw the Murder, She Wrote board game, I was like, holy shit, you have the Murder, She Wrote board game. I've been looking for that for a decent price for years. And she goes, oh yeah, three people have already called about it and asking it if we have it at our store. And I was like, that means I have to get in line as early as possible. Mm-hmm. The week before I missed out on a Star Wars original lunchbox, which I've coveted because I had one when I was a little kid. I actually beat a kid over the head with it when he was bullying me. So, you know, I want to bring back those memories. So I went to the sale at way too early. I'm embarrassed to say how early I got there. I got that. And then I got the thermos that goes with the Star Wars lunchbox that is possibly more valuable than the actual lunchbox to some people because it's hard to find. I don't think this was ever used, honestly.
Wow.
So,
which, I mean, that is so incredibly rare that to find one that's not used. I mean, the whole point of getting those things was to use them, and it wasn't even part of the culture at the time to think I should put this aside and never use it. So, I mean, there's an entire story in how this doesn't end up getting used.
Yeah. I found a few other things, some things I'm not sure I'm going to keep, you know, I might sell them to kind of pay for the stuff that I bought. And I also found a Darth Vader TIE fighter that I wasn't looking for, but it was a price I couldn't pass up. So
I'm a little embarrassed. I was looking at your post and somebody pointed out that that Vader TIE is so cool. I'm like, what tie? I don't see a tie. I'm a bad Star Wars fan.
our cousin Chris, she commented on that post and she said, do you know, it took me about 10 minutes to, I kept looking for this tie.
I'm glad I'm not alone.
You're not alone. It must run in the family or something.
You'll post the photos of that and show people the cool find. Cause that is pretty awesome. And of course it'll make Josh so jealous.
What's funny, here's a funny thing. The estate sale that I went to on Thursday where I found the Darth Vader TIE fighter is across from where Josh grew up because I sent him the sale because they had some other Star Wars stuff. They had not posted the ships, but I sent it to him. He goes, do you know I grew up there? And the kid that lived there was pretty terrible. So, yeah, I got the inside scoop on the people that lived in the house that I got the Darth Vader TIE fighter from. So
nice. All right, let's get into some movies this week, and we're going to start off in a good mood. We'll go to the bad mood after that. Let's start off with something that is really good, at least from my perspective, and that is The People's Joker, written, directed, and starring Vera Drew. This is just complete anarchy, taking the Batman Joker IP and just pissing all over it in the best possible way. Vera Drew basically plays a trans character who they are. They want to be on television. They want to be in comedy. They want to get on this TV show, this very popular TV show that is run by Lorne Michaels. It is not SNL, but it is Lorne Michaels, which I love. But you have to be a specific, type. So they label her a Joker, which is the male character, as opposed to the Harlequins, which are the female characters and are only in the background and are not allowed to have their own characters. So she quits that and goes with her friend Oswald Cobblepot, the Penguin, and creates her own anti-comedy club where they get all these villains who are also doing anti-comedy. And it's all just really, really very, very funny. On top of which, there's this actual, like, genuine, heartful story going on with her and her mom that's happening in the background. Mm-hmm. Not that there's going to be anything truly genuine or emotional going on here, but there is that undercurrent there. It's implied, and I dig that. I dig everything about this movie, though. This movie is so much fun. It's completely insane. The non sequiturs, the reference. I think this movie is a total destruction of Joaquin Phoenix's Joker. Nothing against Joaquin Phoenix, but I just don't like the Joker. And I think this movie just tears that film to shreds, mm-hmm. whether it intended to or not. It just does a great job of kind of unmasking that film for what it is. This is just a great deal of fun, though. It's very funny.
And what I liked about it is it purports to be, you know, the about Gotham City and all that, but it really just uses her obsession with the Joker and Batman growing up as a way to tell her story. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably one of the reasons that it's not being pulled, because it's paying homage while at the same time kind of poking fun. And I don't think that, I don't think there's anything like really to add, except that the queer friendliness of everything in it, and the fact that, you know, the relationship with her mom and the way that organically kind of is shown as she, when she's a child, to the point where, you know, when her mom suddenly has been to therapy, you know, like, and now accepts her. I think that was really nice. And I think that's a good touch for a lot of trans kids who probably never got that relationship with their parents, even as an adult. So that was really nice to see. I wanted a weird movie this week, and mm-hmm. I saw another one that I hated, and then this one that I loved. I mean, this is a movie you have to stay through the credits for, because there's so much little like Easter eggs hidden throughout the credits. The Robert Wool cameo, literally cameo.
Yeah.
Blows me away. The fact that like he, you know, he's like, they're obviously trying to get him mm-hmm. As his character from Batman. And he's like, I can't do this. you know, just stuff like that just is so much fun.
It so is.
I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I had such a great time watching this movie. And I love that, you know, so many people are so precious about Batman and Joker and the DC universe and the Marvel mm-hmm. universe, and they get very defensive about these characters. And it's nice to see these characters taken out of that context and taken into a completely different context to tell somebody else's story. Not that I want everybody to, you know, say that they're going to take people's characters and do whatever they want with them. I mean, there's elements of that on YouTube where, like, people are putting, like, Frozen characters into sexual situations with Spider-Man or some shit. And that's certainly not anything anybody needs to see. But when you can do something that transforms it the way this does and uses it for in such a great way, I think there should be... We need to find a way to be a little bit more lenient and open to these ideas.
Yeah. There's a toxic Star Wars dude who made a fan film and keeps talking about how great it is and all that. And it's just, no, it's not. I would love to see somebody do something like this with a, you know, with Star Wars. The fact that it was a trans coming of age story wrapped inside a Batman parody. I just thought it was so great and thought that, you know, everything was fun and not heavy handed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a member of the Rainbow Mafia, I can say that a lot of LGBT stories that come out in movies can be pretty heavy handed. And, you know, take themselves too seriously. And this does not at all. You know, I liked the fact that they kept bleeping her dead name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, until somebody that she cared about actually called her by that name. And then it was like, whoa. I like that they were able to do the kind of confrontations that she had with people and not sugarcoat them just because they want to make a, you know, a trans story palatable.
Mm-hmm.
Cause this is not going to be palatable for everybody.
Right.
Although, you know, I thought it was put together really well. I thought it was so well done that I'm really glad I saw it.
And what's great, too, and when you talk about trans stories or LGBTQ stories, oftentimes you can get into sort of a misery porn aspect where you're focusing on all the negative things that happen and the obstacles that they have to overcome. And I love the movie Monica. The movie Monica is one of my favorite films of last year, but it is a hard, hard watch. It is a deep drama. And that can be very, you know, that can be very triggering for people. That can also be just kind of depressing to come out of in the end. But and there's nothing wrong with that. Monica, again, great movie. See it. I'm saying that not all trans movies have to be that. Not all LGBTQ movies have to be that. We can tell these stories in a way that's fun and exciting and different and weird. And this movie is fun, exciting, different, and weird. The animated sequences are spectacular. The low budget sets, the DIY aspect of it. I mean, it feels like this movie was made for like $50 on a credit card. That's just just fucking fantastic. The Lorne Michaels running gag is the best. They just have this weird animated character that looks nothing like Lorne Michaels or kind of like Lorne Michaels.
It looks like
and a he just
character from a video game in like 1999.
And he ruled.
Not as put together.
He rules comedy with an iron fist.
Yeah. And also voiced by Maria Bamford. Come on.
Fucking genius.
I liked in the credits, she thanked Warner Brothers Discovery for millions of dollars of free publicity.
Nice.
Yeah, I was just... I did think that the credits went by too fast because I was trying to keep up with them and trying to read the disclaimer at the front about, you know, this is not endorsed by Warner Brothers Discovery, but then it just went by too quickly, so...
Yeah, I think they put it on the poster and intentionally. This is a fair use, a fair use movie. Yep. Which I think it is. I mean, it's you know, what is this, how is this any different from what Weird Al does and taking things that are well known and transforming them? Vera Drew has completely transformed these characters to her will to do what she wants, and I think that's and at the same time provide a pitch perfect parody of these characters, which again, if the Naked Gun gets to do that, or the Airplane movies get to take other movies and turn them inside out, why can't Vera Drew do that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the fact that it does kind of walk that line, and the line gets finer and finer as you go on.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought that was so well done and brave that, you know, she was willing to just, let's do it. You know, let's see what we can get away with.
I know. I love it. Vera Drew, please make a Star Wars, make trans Star Wars, please. I would love to see that.
Well, next up is apparently Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, wow.
Freddy versus the Joker. That was at the very end of the credits. I don't know if you stayed for that.
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah, it was Joker will return in, and then colon, and then it like kind of faded out. Then it faded back up to the Nightmare on Elm Street house. And Freddy's arm comes out, grabs the Joker, and then it says the people's nightmare, Freddy versus the Joker. So
that's incredible. That is absolutely incredible. And I take my money right now. If I paid to get into movies, take my money right now.
Yep.
But I don't pay to get into movies. And that's what really is the only saving grace about our next movie, is that I didn't have to pay to see Sasquatch Summer. Sasquatch Summer.
You asshole.
Sasquatch Summer is a movie of sorts. it kind of qualifies. Directed by Nathan and David Zellner, written by David Zellner, and starring Jesse Eisenberg, Riley Keough, Nathan Zellner, and Christoph Zajac-Denik as Sasquatches. They put on these really elaborate Sasquatch costumes. They went into the woods and they filmed themselves doing various Sasquatch activities. Like most of the film, I think most of the runtime is basically one of the characters scratching their genitals and then smelling their finger. Mm-hmm. And that takes up a good 2/3 of the movie. that isn't taken up by nose picking or getting super honey and waving their tiny little dicks around. My theory on this, Jeff, is that Sasquatch Summer isn't a movie. It's a prank. It's a prank on anybody who pays money to watch this. And the people who like this movie are people who paid money to watch this and are now trying to justify the fact that they paid money to watch this. That's my theory. Because I gotta say, the Sasquatch costumes, incredible, flawless, flawless costumes. The cinematography is terrific. It's a gorgeous setting. And then you have these disgusting Sasquatches pissing and throwing their poop at things and dying. And they just wanted to see how many people would willingly pay money to watch them fuck around. And there is part of me that kind of admires that as a sort of a shit post as a movie. Like I can see the appeal as a filmmaker of making a movie just as a middle finger to the audience and like a kind of Andy Kaufman style thing. But it doesn't justify me having spent 89 minutes watching this because I didn't do anything. Yeah. I didn't do anything to the Zellner brothers to deserve this. I just showed up to their movie.
I'll tell you what, I got there. It was early in the morning for me and was watching it. And right about the first 15 minutes, I started to drift off and fall asleep. And I kind of wish I had just leaned back in my chair and taken a nap because God, it was boring. It was, like you said, the costumes are amazing.
Mm-hmm.
They look so realistic. I like the fact that they did film it near the area of the Patterson film, of, you know, the famous Bigfoot film.
Mm-hmm.
I like Jesse Eisenberg. I like Riley Keough. There were two ways that I feel like you could have done it better. You could have done it as a satire on nature documentaries, which I think it was kind of going for.
Mm-hmm.
But you needed like a David Attenborough narrator. I think that would have been a much better satire.
Mm-hmm.
That was like the one I was like, okay, I get what they're kind of going for. It's kind of like, you know, they're following the Sasquatch in nature, but it really just didn't land the way I think that they were going for. The other thing that I would have loved to have seen is if they were doing stuff like actively hiding from humans,
mm-hmm.
you know, and like making a game of it or something like that, you know, or coming up against humans who are doing the logging that they were discovering the trees with the big red X's on. But it fell flat when, you know, the father Sasquatch gets high on pot and mushrooms and goes and tries to fuck a leopard or a mountain lion and gets eaten.
Mm-hmm.
I just was like, whoa. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that a faux nature documentary would have made more sense with. I do have to say there are two moments in the movie that I really liked.
Hmm.
One was when they find the campsite and they get the boombox and they start to play Erasure's Love to Hate You, which I love that song. And I was like, oh, maybe this is where they're going to like have a dance party or something, you know? No, instead they just wreck the campsite.
Mm-hmm.
I would have welcomed a dance party at that point. The other moment, and it's just a fleeting moment that I really thought was great. And I owe it to Riley Keough. She's got the baby that she has a baby Sasquatch that is really disturbing looking animatronic thing. And it's nursing. And she then, as it's nursing, the toddler / young Sasquatch goes up and nurses on her other breast, which it has done throughout mm-hmm. the movie. So right. It wasn't anything. And the look that she gives while they're both suckling on her breast is just this. Oh God, is this my life? And that's kind of how I felt watching the movie.
I initially thought that we were going to get talking Sasquatches, and I liked the idea of a Jesse Eisenberg type speaking as a Sasquatch, because uh-huh. again, it doesn't fit. Those two things are opposite each other, it would seem. And I thought that'd be interesting. I would like to hear, you know, this this sort of anxious, weird Sasquatch from New York. But what we don't get that. We don't get him. He doesn't say that. All they do is grunt and pick their nose and pee and poop in their hands and throw it at things and smell their fingers after they've scratched their genitals. And they do that multiple times in this movie.
So I did figure out why she keeps scratching her genitals and then sniffing them. That's how she's trying to figure out if she's pregnant, because they must emit some sort of pheromone out of their vagina.
Perhaps that doesn't explain why the other two were doing it.
Well, they were jerking off. And it was her. It was just her who was like fingering herself and smelling it. The other two were just jerking off.
The other two were doing the same thing, I think. I think they were all doing it. Unfortunately, it felt like everyone was doing it, and for most of the movie that felt like the only thing that was happening in the film was that. This is produced by Ari Aster, and I know there's a lot of people, and there's probably somebody thinking, well, if Ari Aster can be, you know, weird and different, why can't this movie be weird and different? And he's weird and different with a point. I'm not sure what Ari Aster saw in this movie. If he saw anything in it, maybe he just slapped his name on it, who knows, but his style of absurdism is actual absurdism. This isn't absurd, this is just gross. It's just it's pointless grossness that does nothing and it pretends toward being some kind of work of art. But the reality is that this is just a couple of guys shitposting as a movie.
Yep.
All right. Another guy shitposting as a movie is Guy Ritchie with the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, starring Henry Cavill, Alan Ritchson, and several other actors. It's based on a true story of a real life World War II incident in which a group of soldiers were tasked with going to this place to try and stop U-boats from being able to refuel easily, and thus opening up the ocean to get the Americans to England. Great true story, really fascinating true story, and some of these characters are the real people, or are based on the real people that did this. But the problem with that I find is that this is a movie is so flippant and so action movie clever that it kind of feels to me like it felt disrespectful to the true story, I guess, which is, I know, maybe kind of a weird way to think of it, but it feels like it degrades the actual story to turn these characters, turn these real life people into these flippant action movie characters who are constantly have a quip and are constantly, you know, the coolest guy in the room. Maybe they were the coolest guy in the room back in the day. It just doesn't feel real though in the movie.
Yeah. I didn't see it. I had to go see Sasquatch Sunset
Guy Ritchie's style is just sort of repetitive. It's just sort of the sameness of his style of action just continues in this movie. I like Henry Cavill and Alan Ritchson. I think they're fun. I think they're having fun doing this. And I think it's nice to pay tribute to these real life heroes who did these, who made this incredible thing happen. But I don't know. It left me feeling kind of empty at the end, because it feels like every action movie is this. And this is a story that I feel like maybe deserves better. Maybe it deserved a director who isn't Guy Ritchie and isn't doing a Guy Ritchie thing.
Like Matthew Vaughn? Just kidding.
You know, you never see those two in the same room at the same time. It's weird. It's so weird. Well, finishing our conversation about Guy Ritchie, let's talk about vampires. Of course, Abigail came out this week. This one is directed by Matt Bettinelli-Ulpin and Tyler Gillette, and stars Melissa Barrera, Catherine Newton, Dan Stevens, Kevin Duran, Alicia Weir, in the story of a little girl vampire who gathers a group of people into a place so she can snack on them and hunt them for fun. And we know this from the trailer, which kind of ruins the entire movie. Oh. And I know I've been yelled at apparently on social media because I said that the trailer kind of ruins the movie, and they said that's not a valid criticism. Why is that not a valid criticism?
Absolutely it is. Absolutely it is. Because this movie, if I did not know going into it that the little girl was a vampire and that she was going to eat them all, it would have been one of the most effective twists in a horror movie in years. So that's absolutely a valid criticism.
It's completely valid, because it does. It ruins the entire movie. The movie is literally directed with an intentional misdirection to keep you from knowing that she's a little girl vampire. They set up this sort of fake character who... So basically, she's a little girl who has a very powerful, rich father who... they kidnap her for ransom money. They're going to hold her until the dad pays like $7 million, and there's like six of them. So there's like each going to get like close to $1 million or whatever. They're holding her, and they find out who the dad is, and they find out he's a legendary criminal who's very, you know, violent, and has a henchman who is kind of legendary for being a stealthy killer. And that's the misdirect, is that you think that this killer has found the house and is maybe stalking these people. But the reality is, of course, it's actually Abigail, the little girl. And so it's played the entire, you know, first act and a half are played as if this is something that the movie is intentionally trying to hide so that it can reveal this to you. And it just speaks to the fact that they put that in the trailer, Jeff, because of Megan. Plain and simple. Oh, it's yeah. there because oh, of Megan. Yeah. If Megan isn't successful, as successful as it is, this doesn't end up in the trailer.
Yep. You know, they, so you're trying, they're like, oh yeah, he's got this henchman that kills everybody very stealthily. And then you're led to believe it's Dan Stevens' character. Then it could be Melissa Barrera's character or William Catlett's character, because they're all very, they all have pasts that would lend themselves to being a hitman.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody really knows anything about them. And then I kept thinking the whole time, knowing from the trailer that she's a vampire, and the very first shot of the movie is her dancing to Swan Lake, which would have been a good clue if you didn't know she was a vampire, because of the fact that that's the Swan Lake is the music they used for the original 1931 Dracula. That plays over the credits. And as soon as you hear that, I mean, as soon as I hear that anyway, I cannot help but think of Dracula. Everywhere I'm at, I hear Swan Lake, I'm like, ooh, Dracula. Well, hearing it over the beginning credits of this movie, knowing she was a vampire, I was like, oh, that's really clever. Because if you know, you know. If you don't, it's just, you know, classical music.
Mm-hmm.
This, like you said in your review and just now, knowing what the twist of this movie is makes it really hard to say whether it was good or not. I personally thought it was excellent. I'm not even a huge vampire fan most of the time, especially modern vampires, but I mean, the cast was great. You know, Alicia Weir, who plays Abigail, she was really good, and she just was having a lot of fun as this character who got all these people who had fucked over her dad to come to this place. Catherine Newton was the kind of standout for me. I like her now. I didn't really like her when I first saw her, I guess. She was a little annoying and freaky, but this movie, she really kind of like really steps up. And when she's actually possessed, that's one of my favorite scenes, because she just plays it for every little, you know, googly eye and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I liked Melissa Barrera. I thought that was a good choice. A complicated character who has a reason to be here, but is also kind of does have a moral compass about doing what she's doing, and you know, vowing to protect Abigail against everybody else. I thought that was a really effective character. The problem, though, that let's just put aside the fact that the trailer completely ruins the movie, makes it really impossible to say if it's any good or not. I think the third act is a mess. I think what they do with the vampire lore is so lazy, and I'll explain it, because they basically what the screenwriters of this movie are doing is like, okay, we'll take away a couple of the well-known tropes about what vampires are vulnerable to, but then we're going to add a couple different layers of our own lore as needed, as dramatic, you know, twists. And I think that is just so lazy. I find that to be, it feels like they're painting themselves into corners and then creating new rules to get themselves out of it. And I find that to be the laziest form of screenwriting. You know, I'm not precious about vampires. They don't all have to have the same vulnerabilities or anything, but there's a pretty well-established vampire lore that gives you kind of a good roadmap of where to go with this, and creates genuine, you know, drama and tension within the, you know, the vampire character universe. When you try and then mess with that and when you're trying to use those rules and then come up with new ones. Like, there's this whole thing about if you want to kill one of these vampires, which there are going to be multiple different vampires made during this movie as part of the action that occurs, that you have to, the only way to kill them, you have to drain them completely. And then the character doesn't do that specifically for plot reasons, not because it's not for any other reason. They just need that other character to be alive, so they don't finish them off and they go and do something else. And that's just, again, it just says to me that they're just being completely lazy and making up the rules as they go along. And that really just, that moved me the wrong way. We're going to talk about the ending, because I do have something I want to bring up about this ending. So, spoiler alert, if you want to see this movie, jump out now and go see it and come back. The movie's already been spoiled for you, but nevertheless, if you don't want to know exactly how the movie ends, they go so hard, they go so vague on the vampire lore of this movie, because there's no real reason for any of these characters to know any vampire lore. There's no, they're, in their world, they're currently, as they enter this story, they don't think there are any vampires in the world. They've never heard of vampires in this world. They're fictional characters, other than the fictional characters. So obviously it makes sense for them to not know what vampires are actually capable of. But this thing happens at the end where Melissa Barrera's character is essentially turned by Dan Stevens' character into a vampire. So that he can, and this apparently gives him mental control over her, so he can make her kill Abigail. But then when he dies, is she no longer a vampire? Which I guess is kind of to the classic lore, if you kill the vampire who turns you. But at the same, it's too vague about
that. Abigail actually says that to Joe. Joey. I caught that very, very specifically. She goes, "Oh my God, I'm gonna be a vampire." She's like, "No, he's dead. You're fine. When your host or when your sire is dead, then you revert." Ooh. I mean, not different words, but yeah, it's definitely spelled out in the movie. So
I didn't hear that, because I thought the whole thing, it's a lot of chaos in that last act to cover up for all the things that are wrong with it.
And my only problem with the last act is there were just one too many climaxes.
Mm-hmm.
There were like three different climaxes and there's just one too many, you know?
But I have this one complaint that I want to get into, because I think it's illustrative of sort of filmmaking technique and the way the camera works. So they decide to bring Abigail's dad into the story at the very last minute. They mm-hmm. introduce him. And what they do is that they have the camera down low pointing up, and you see a man walk in and his face is sort of obscured in the darkness. And you can see he's got a beautiful suit, great shoes, good looking, and they're going to pan up and reveal his face. And they reveal that it's Matthew Good. And I'm sorry, no offense, Matthew Good, this is not anything that's going to take someone's breath away. If you're going to do a reveal like this, where the camera makes what you're looking at seem more important than it is, you can't just reveal an actor where most of the audience is going, "Who's that guy?"
Yeah.
Matthew Good is not a big star. I'm sorry, he's not. He doesn't have a Q rating. Most people don't know who he is. That's not a slight on his talent. It's a slight on the fact that he's just not that well known. So the reveal of him as the dad of Abigail is going to leave the majority of the audience going, "Wait, who's that guy? What are we looking at?"
Yeah.
It's Abigail's dad. Okay, it's Abigail's dad, but who is he? If you're going to do a big reveal like that, it's got to be like Robert Downey Jr. or it's got to be some infamous figure or some, you know, legendary vampire. Robert Pattinson. It's Edward that from Twilight. Like some shit like that, where it just where it's a reveal that's going to make the audience go, "Oh my God." But you're not Wouldn't doing that when you're looking at Matthew Good.
If it was Robert Pattinson and just like, he had like a twinkle that you think might be in his eye, but it could be on his cheek or something. It's just as a like a haha moment.
Yeah. I mean, but then, again, the camera lends an importance to what you're doing. And when you're going to do this as a reveal, you can't just reveal somebody that nobody has a clue who he is.
Yeah.
It's bad direction when you do that. You needed to put this character in earlier in the film and establish him somewhere in the universe. That way, when it comes back later on, oh, that was her dad.
Yeah. I mean, I know they were going for that parallel between him and Abigail and then the statue of them. But it fell flat for me because I was like, A, it was the very last shot of the movie where he, you know, they bring him in. And second of all, he doesn't need to be, there's no reason for him to actually show up. He's this figure that they're talking about and they're so scared of, but what, you know, it would have to be somebody that had been in a vampire movie or like you said, Robert Pattinson or something like that, where it's kind of a wink, not the guy who played one of the forgettable characters in Watchmen, you know,
exactly.
Osman Diaz, I think.
Yeah. I would have had just the thing ends and a limo pulls up and the door opens and you don't see who's inside. And Abigail just gets inside, like resigned to like, my dad's here, I guess, but you know, he's never here usually, that kind of thing. Like just a sort of sad resignation for her. That's what happens anyway with the Matthew Good character. She's just sort of sadly resigned to maybe he'll try more now. As a dad, but you're getting the same. You'd get the same thing from not revealing him as you would from revealing him. Plus, if your movie's successful and you're going to have a sequel, then you have a character that you can reveal and use in the sequel. It's such a weird choice. I was trying to recall. There are many other movies that do this thing where the main character, you know, this secret cameo character gets revealed. Like, I don't know why I will jump to this, but Cannonball Run 2 does it, where like throughout the movie they refer to this character who as, oh, he's American royalty, he's the chairman, you know, he's the biggest, most important human being in the world, and then they reveal it's Frank Sinatra. And at the time, Sinatra hadn't been in a movie in 4 years. He's kind of on a low ebb in his career, but seeing Frank Sinatra sitting behind a desk and greeting Burt Reynolds, it made you go, whoa, that's Frank Sinatra. Because everybody knows who he is. Nobody knows who Matthew Good is. That's not the kind of actor he is. And I saw the directors trying to explain the big reveal. They wanted somebody who could communicate menace in a sort of way, like communicate a sort of smooth, gentlemanly menace, like a classic vampire character. And that's not a bad choice, but I understand the idea behind it, but you've chosen an actor that nobody knows. You're leaving the audience just going, who's that guy? Yeah. He looks familiar. He looks like an actor I know. Am I supposed to know who that is? And you're missing the ending of the movie trying to figure out what's going on.
It really would have made more sense to have Giancarlo Esposito be your father. You know, he was the one, he was trying to get back in her good graces or something, so he let all these people come in so she could kill him. I mean, that would make more sense than, I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but it would have made more sense than just having random Matthew Good pop up.
You know what, not a missed opportunity because they could never do it, but they wanted, I think they would, if you're going to do this, you want like David Bowie. If Bowie had been that, if that had been Bowie, the world, you know, like the entire room explodes because, like, perfect.
Because he was a vampire, you know, he played a vampire.
Not only that, but he's David fucking Bowie.
Yeah, but I mean, like, he is somebody who's iconic, but he's also played a vampire.
Yeah, it's got multiple layers. Matthew Good has no layers. There are no layers there. And it's not a comment on his talent. He's very talented. He's an incredibly handsome dude. He's just not known. We don't know who he is. Don't reveal him like we're supposed to gasp at the sight of him.
Uh-huh.
And that's what they do. And it's just a demonstrative of not being a very good director when you use the tools of directing this way improperly, and you create an expectation in the audience that you then don't fulfill.
Yeah, I would have been fine with him not being revealed at all, and then, you know, Abigail and Joey teaming up in the sequel that'll probably come, because, you know, he was expecting Abigail to kill everybody, but she leaves Joey alive, so he's gonna, you know, set Joey up or something.
Yeah, I mean, I thought what we were building to, because I wasn't sure if she was still a vampire or not, because I guess I missed that line of dialogue. Yeah. And again, it's very chaotic at the end, so I feel perfectly justified in having missed that, because there's a lot of chaotic music and action going on the entire time during that. But I think what
I love how the vampires die by exploding. I love that.
That was good. I thought she was going to, now that I'm a vampire, I'm just resigned to this life. I thought she was going to take care of Abigail, and then the sequel would be them, you know, going after her dad for not being a good enough dad.
Yeah.
Maybe taking down his entire criminal empire as vampires. I thought that's kind of an interesting idea, but nope, that's not what happens. It just sort of peters out.
Yeah. I mean, overall, I thought it was a solid movie. Really, I liked everybody's performance in it, with the exception of, I know I'm good, Angus Cloud. Rest in peace. I just didn't like his character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that yo girl, let's get together. You know, let's kick it. And I'm just like, yeah, you're played out. Catherine Newton, I thought was great. Like I said, I liked everybody's characterizations, but I thought Catherine Newton kind of, her and Melissa Barrera were really the ones who stood out to me of the adults.
Absolutely. And yeah, for me, Melissa Barrera above everybody. I thought that was the best performance in the movie and the most appealing aspect of the movie as well. But
yeah, after Scream 5, I really have started to like her. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't like her in Scream 5.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's in part due to the fact that she's Billy Loomis's daughter, and, you know, she's like psycho and keeps saying serial killer when she means spree killer. You know, I that's kind of, I never really cared for her after that. I started to like her in Scream 6, and I really liked her here. I did like her in The Heights. So,
yeah, I don't hate the movie. I don't think it's a bad movie per se. I think it's just got a lot of little problems that add up to an even bigger problem. And I really can't say, again, is this a really good movie or not? Because I didn't get to experience the movie that the filmmakers made.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. People were saying that this is not a valid criticism. I don't see how it's not a valid criticism. I'm not actually intending to criticize the filmmakers. I don't think this, clearly their intention is on screen. They wanted this to be a reveal. Whoever marketed the film made the choice to tell everybody what the twist was. That's the choice that the marketers made. And that's the choice I'm
criticizing. The filmmakers, you are criticizing the marketing department, and that's completely valid. I think I would have liked to have seen Radio Silence go after them too. You know what I mean?
Ooh. What is Radio Silence? I keep hearing about Radio Silence.
That's the directors. That's their name working together.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
When they did Ready or Not, that's the first time I heard of them. So
that's a good movie. I like Ready or Not a lot.
Yeah.
But this could have been a pretty good movie. I've got a problem with the final act, I think, is a mess. But it could have been a pretty good movie, but I didn't get to see the movie that they made. I got to see the movie that the marketers ruined. And that's the thing, is this is an experience that none of us can ever have now. The marketing team of this movie took away the actual experience of this movie. Like, there are audiences somewhere who actually got to see this movie without seeing the trailer, maybe, and actually got to see the vision of the filmmakers, and we did not.
I did. I got to see the trailer for Long Legs ahead of this movie, and or ahead of Sasquatch. And let me tell you, that's a trailer that does not give away anything. I saw that and The Strangers. And The Strangers gives away everything. It's just basically remaking the same movie for the third time. But the trailer for Long Legs is what I wish the Abigail trailer had been.
Mm, yeah. But we will never have that experience. So there that is. All right. Our classic this week, because we're talking about a vampire movie and because I've never seen Christopher Lee's take on Dracula, I've not seen the Hammer take on Dracula, we decided to watch The Horrors of Dracula from 1950. Horror of Dracula, starring Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing and Michael Goff. On it's pretty much the Dracula story. Jeff?
It's a little different in that Jonathan Harker goes to try to kill Dracula, not because he's taking a job like in the 1931 version. And then it kind of becomes, it gives Dracula a reason, you know, to seek revenge. This is just Dracula in the United Kingdom. But when they brought it over to America, they had to name it something else because of the fact that the Bela Lugosi Dracula was still being played in revival houses and road shows. So that's why they called it Horror of Dracula. It's the same general story, but I love the way that it's just tweaked a little bit. Christopher Lee is an amazing Dracula. He only has like 10 lines of movie, or 10 lines in the entire movie. Or 17 lines in the last 10 minutes of the movie, or within 10 minutes of the movie. And it's like, he's so iconic in that role. I actually did a print and a sticker of him in that. And it's one that I've always had to reprint because people just seem to really dig him as Dracula. I want to get your thoughts though.
He's tall and imposing, and he definitely has, that is a menacing vibe that is impressive. He fills out that Dracula uniform very, very well. I had to laugh at his death. His death scene is very funny to me. That is some high camp special effects, especially with when you see like he's in the sun. He's been caught in the sun by Peter Cushing. He is turning to ash, and then you see his head turn to ash, and you can see his stupid looking teeth. I burst out laughing. He looks like, you know, Dan Aykroyd in Coneheads with the teeth. It looks like there's like three rows of teeth on Christopher Lee.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
Peter Cushing is a solid Van Helsing. He's very intelligent and witty, and he has great chemistry with Michael Goff. Those two bounce off each other really, really well. Goff plays, of course. I guess they've changed the character dynamic. Have they changed those character dynamics from who's married to who?
Just kind of an update.
I was kind of because again I'm very familiar with the original 31 Dracula. That one's incredible. So I was trying to figure, like, Michael Goff's character is married to Mina, and then his sister Lucy was with Harker.
Yeah, Lucy was. That's kind of always been the way it is, but it's not. I think it's just because of the fact that the character of Jonathan Harker, you know, is a little more. Has a little more agency in this one than he does in the 1931 version, and even Bram Stoker's Dracula. So, but
I don't think this is bad. It's good. No. It's solid. It's well made. I don't like it nearly as much as the 31. I don't think that's not a in any way a degrading of this movie. It's just that that one is what it is. It establishes it's the centerpiece. It's the thing that creates the myth and the lore and the legend. And you know, Bela Lugosi just lives that character so very, very well. I'll probably not get over that particular Dracula anytime soon. I've just never seen anybody live up to that for me.
Yeah, that was just completely valid. I like both of them, for different reasons, but I do prefer the 1931 version. I think this is just a different enough take on it that I can enjoy both of them equally.
It feels a little bit though, like it does make Hammer to me, like I've always imagined what Hammer was like, and you know, based off of other people's impressions of what they do, and it made it feel like a company that just sort of does IP knockoffs. And I know that's probably pretty harsh. I know there's probably Hammer fans who are like, how dare you say such a thing? But it does kind of feel like that, because it's different, but it's not that different.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
I don't see a whole lot of innovation or even technologically. I don't think this is, I think actually the first film, the 1931, is actually more technically accomplished.
Yeah, this is very much of its time, of the late 50s, early 60s in horror movies. And mm-hmm. I guess for me, calling it a, you know, we remake IP is a little bit disingenuous, because of the fact that the book, you know, millions of versions of the book and the TV miniseries and the movies have been made. It's in the public domain. So I guess when you say ripping off an IP, I don't see it as that way. I just think, you know, they've got they can do it because it's in the public domain. So they're going to, you know, they used a lot of public domain stuff, much like Universal did. So
yeah, it feels like an IP capitalization to me. Like, Dracula's available, let's make a Dracula movie. That's just, I just don't think there's enough about it to separate it, to give it to any kind of newness. There's no subtext. There's nothing to tell you that this movie was made in the late 1950s. It's not used in a way that reveals anything about the time frame in which it was made. And that would have given it something, a reason to exist beyond IP capitalization.
Fair enough.
All right. Next week, we've got Boy Kills World and Challengers. Really looking forward to seeing Challengers a lot. I've heard amazing things about Challengers. So that's what I'm looking forward to, Jeff. You got one? Which one are you able? Are you aiming for?
Well, I'll be able to see Challengers, although I'm not sure exactly what date. I do have my birthday off, which is Sunday, so
oh, nice.
Maybe I'll go see that. I don't know. After this week, which was such a up and down week for me as far as movies go, I don't know. I'm looking forward to picking a classic that, you know, we can all kind of get behind.
I will leave that to you. But let's get into some flick chart very briefly here. Unfaithful, starring Diane Lane, or In Her Shoes, starring Cameron Diaz?
Unfaithful.
I kind of prefer In Her Shoes. It's actually, it's not that bad. Her and Tony Collette are really good in that.
I'm sorry. I was thinking of something else.
So the coin says In Her Shoes wins, so that's cool.
Okay, that's fine.
Next up is Jaws the Revenge, or Operation Dumbo Drop.
Oh my God. Jesus Christ.
Can we drop Dumbo on Jaws 4? That'd be great.
The only... you know what? I'm going to pick Jaws just because fucking... Michael Caine did it for the money.
I'm picking Jaws the Revenge because it is fun to make fun of that movie. It is so bad. It is so bad, but it is so much fun to make fun of. Grumpier old men or old school?
Grumpier old men.
Same. I just don't think old school holds up. Whereas Grumpier Old Men has at least several very, very funny lines, and Burgess Meredith is just, he is eating every scene until his death scene. Aww. Crazy Rich Asians or Annabelle?
Crazy Rich Asians.
Same.
Although, the first 10 minutes of Annabelle is actually really good. But the rest of the movie sucks.
Child's Play 2019 or Pride and Prejudice with Keira Knightley?
Pride and Prejudice. Fuck the Child's Play 2019 movie. I feel like it would have been a better movie if they hadn't tried to remake Child's Play.
Yeah.
If they'd said, you know, Buddy or something like that, and like changed up the look of the doll, I would have been fine with it. I like killer doll movies, but
for some reason it's giving us old school again, this time up against But I'm a Cheerleader.
Definitely. Hands fucking down.
Definitely. Accepted starring Justin Long or Up in Smoke, Cheech and Chong?
Up in Smoke.
I just watched a YouTuber watch Up in Smoke. This girl named Ashley on YouTube. She's so funny watching it. It just makes me love that movie.
Up in Smoke and Still Smoking and White Chicks are the only movies I ever saw my dad almost pee his pants laughing at. My dad was not a stoner, to my knowledge. I'm sure he probably did, but to my knowledge, he was not a pot smoker. But watching him laugh so hard that he could barely breathe. I'll always really like those movies because of that.
Fair enough. The Outsiders or 12 Years a Slave?
Oh, 12 Years a Slave is the better movie.
Definitely.
I'm never going to watch it again.
No doubt. Let's see here. An Inconvenient Truth or Margot at the Wedding?
Margot at the Wedding.
I'm going Inconvenient Truth. I think Margot at the Wedding is Noah Baumbach's least effective film. But Margot wins.
I just really like Anne Hathaway in that movie.
Halloween 2, 2009, or Cocktail?
Cocktail. I hate Tom Cruise, but fuck Rob Zombie. And
Hobo Joe, the fill-in for the villain in that movie. Hobo Joe. Yeah. Alien versus Predator Requiem or Red Eye?
Red Eye.
Red Eye by a lot. Very underrated. Red Eye's
a really good movie.
La Bamba or Colossal starring Anne Hathaway?
It's been a long time since I saw La Bamba, but Colossal. I like Colossal, but I'm going to pick La Bamba.
I'm going to go with La Bamba. I think La Bamba is a far better film than its reputation. I think it's got an amazing backstory, and the direction of it is incredible. Colossal's awesome. I love that movie. I love the idea. It's such a big swing. I totally dig it. But I think La Bamba is kind of underrated for what it is. Unbroken, directed by Angelina Jolie, or Heaven Can Wait with Warren Beatty?
Unbroken.
Yeah, Unbroken's kind of good. Hudson Hawk or Gravity?
Gravity.
Gravity by a lot. Yeah, Hudson Hawk is terrible. so terrible. I mean... let's see here. Alone in the Dark 2005 or The Spiderwick Chronicles?
Alone in the Dark 2005.
Christian Slater, Tara Reid.
I don't think I saw that one. I did see The Alone in the Dark with Martin Landau and Jack Palance, though.
Yeah, no, this one is this one's really bad. Spiderwick Chronicles wins by a lot. Okay. Garden State or Pleasantville?
I know that Garden State is the one that people who like Sasquatch Summer would pick.
Oh, fuck.
No, I like both of the movies. Pleasantville, I remember we rented it on VHS, and I was just like, oh, this is such a cool movie. You know, like, I dug the conceit of it and whatever. Garden State is probably the better movie, though.
Yeah, I'm picking Garden State for sure.
I know. Duh. Oh, I'm so surprised.
Friday Night Lights or Before Sunset?
Before Sunset.
Yeah, I love Before Sunset. The whole Before series is brilliant. Sky High or Lean on Me?
I don't think I saw most of Sky High, so I'm going to pick Lean on Me. Just
no, Bob would pick Sky High, but I'm going to go Lean on Me. All right, last one. And this is a genuinely tough choice. They're very different movies, but they're both, in my opinion, really great movies. The Green Knight or Ratatouille?
Green Knight.
Same. Yeah, Green Knight. I love Ratatouille, but fucking Green Knight is incredible. All right, Jeff. Next week, you'll have to come up with a classic.
I mean, it's my birthday. Should we do the horrible, terrible happy birthday to me? No, we shouldn't. I don't even want to watch that movie. So I'll think of something.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Bye.